Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are joined by Andrew Boriga, an author and editor originally hailing from the Bronx. His debut novel, Victim, tells the story of a born hustler, Javier Perez, who fabricates a dramatic past to exploit for clout, college admissions, and a flourishing writing career. Andrew and I talk today about how he thinks about his own audience, how his experiences as a writer factored into this book, and all about reading his own Goodreads reviews. Don't forget, the Stacks Book Club pick for April is The January Children by Safia El Hilo, which we will discuss on Wednesday, April 24th with Hala Alyan. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on today's episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. Listen up. The Stacks is an independent podcast, and there are now 2 ways you can support this show. One is, of course, the Stacks Pack, and the other is my brand new Substack, which I call Unstacked. Both places allow for you to get inside access to me and this podcast for $5 a month. They both make the show possible every week, and yes, you can join both. But if you're trying to figure out what's the difference between the Stacks Pack and Unstacked, let me break it down for you super quick. If you want a community of readers to discuss books with, whether through our virtual book club, on our Discord, Patreon is the place for you. Go to patreon.com/thestacks and join. If you're here because you want more of my thoughts on books and pop culture, things like all of my hot takes on Cowboy Carter, you can head to Unstacked at tracythomas.substack.com. And both places, Patreon and Substack, do get my monthly bonus episode of The Stacks Unabridged. So please, please, please head to patreon.com/thestacks or tracythomas.substack.com and help me make this Stacks every single week. Also, worth noting, a fun perk of the Stacks Pack on Patreon is getting a shout out on the show. So thank you so much to Taryn Orosky, Rebecca Jeevan, Vaughn Johnson, Beth, Melissa Kilmque, Deanna Fetish, Minda Honey, and Courtney Moore. Thank you all so much, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack and all of my folks over on Unstacked for helping me to make this show. Okay. It is now time for my conversation with Andrew Boriga. All right, everybody. I'm very excited. I've got a debut author with me today. One of my most anticipated books of the year. The book is Victim. The author is Andrew Boriga. Andrew, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited. Before we talk about the book, I have to out you as the person who tried to bring me down and failed. I met Andrew in Kansas City when I was at this writer's conference thing that I had no business being at. And I was talking to him about sports because he's a baseball fan, which we'll get to. And I use one of my favorite terms, which is I called someone chesty like 5 times. And after I did it like the fifth time, Andrew's like, what does chesty mean? And I was like, what do you mean? What does chesty mean? And he was like, I've never heard that before. And I was like, it's a word that you use to describe people who are like chesty, who are brash in your face, assholes. I was like, Draymond Green is chesty. You know, Richard Sherman is chesty. And he and this other guy we were with were like, never heard it. Made it up. You made it up. And so then I took it to Instagram. And then someone on Instagram found a dictionary definition. And the number one dictionary definition is a brash person. Number two is a big busted person. So Andrew, you tried it with me and you lost. Thank you for listening to the Stacks.
That's it, right? It's over.
Episode over.
Hey, I learned something. I saw that definition and I was like, okay. You know, I assumed it was like a California thing. I had never heard that.
It's so funny because I did like the whole poll on Instagram and a lot of people had never heard it. They're like, oh, I just, you know, I kind of assumed what you meant when you said it, whatever. And so I was actually shocked that the dictionary definition was what I'd been saying, because I was like, oh, I must have made this up somewhere along the way. But speaking of chesty people, your book stars one of the chestiest characters.
Yes.
Why don't you tell folks in 30 seconds or so about Victim?
Yeah, so Javi Perez, the main character of Victim, definitely chesty, now that I know what it means. He's basically somebody who really wants to be a writer, a famous writer, successful writer, whatever that means to him. And he sort of realizes early on in high school, basically, that if he writes about his adversity, his background, his trauma, and if he even stretches the truth a little bit, he will kind of get to where he wants to be even faster. And so he does that. Until things get a little bit out of hand and he sort of comes to realization about like how he's gone too far. But there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens in between then.
And we won't spoil things for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all you need to know, chesty writer,
very chesty,
maybe likes to stretch the truth. it's funny because it starts sort of like with him applying for college.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where it starts for a lot of people about like, oh, this is a way that I can like,
you're interested in my background.
Oh, you're interested in this. This is so, cause like your parents are never interested. Your parents are like, I lived it, bitch.
Yeah.
But you're
exactly.
Like, oh, college advisor. You want me to talk about my life? Okay.
Exactly.
I want to know where you got the idea for the book.
Yeah. So it's something that developed over a long period of time, to be honest. It started with this friendship story. So Gio is another character in the novel who's like Bobby's best friend. He goes away to prison, comes out and like reunites him, obviously not doing his whole thing. But I would say it started around like 2020 when I was like, had been in journalism for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And watching like the media industry and sort of like the demand that I was seeing for like stories based on trauma or like adversity, poverty, and not just like, you know, those stories are valid, right? They're important, but like it was the only stories that I was sort of editors were like interested in me writing after a while. And I was just like, what the fuck? Right. And so like, you know, I wanted to basically talk about this like nationwide obsession. It was seeming with like adversity, trauma, you know, but like how, even though there are some good things to that and it's like important to write about and talk about it, I felt like a lot of it was seemingly like shallow, you know? Mm. And I was like, wanted to find a way to write about it through a character who had agency, who was like making decisions, even though they're bad ones. And so I just landed on this idea, like, even though I, personally in my real life, I was like starting to turn down things and like back away from opportunities. Cause I was just like, this is getting weird.
Yeah.
I was like, what if somebody just kind of ran with it? You know, what if somebody was like, nah, that's what the market wants. I'm going to give them exactly what they want. Kind of like a hustler, kind of like, you know, play into the game. And when I landed on that, it was something that felt really fun. And it allowed me to like explore a lot of like complicated questions and you know, things that I didn't really have to answer to, but just to like explore it through fiction and through this character who was like really interesting. And again, making not great decisions, but like really believing in what he was doing and trying to like understand that.
Yeah. Okay, wait. This is a really specific question and we're not spoiling the book and you are not to name a name. This is a yes or no question.
Okay.
Is Rebecca a real person?
She is based on like a few real people.
Okay.
Yeah.
People, when you read the book and you get to that part, you'll know, but it had to be asked. I want to talk about audience.
Yeah.
Who were you thinking of as your audience when you were writing the book? And now that the book has been in the world for a little bit, is that who's reading the book?
That's a great question. My audience, I mean, I was trying to address like a wide range of people, I would think, you know. I mean, first and foremost, I was writing it for myself, really, to like understand it myself and like, where do I fall on some of these things, but also for writers, other writers or friends of mine that I know who are like writers of color who are kind of going through this and like we secretly talk about, especially if they are like staff writers and stuff or like in the media often, like we talk about these things. For the editors who like maybe do some of this stuff,
right?
You know, and a lot of them I think are like well-intentioned too and don't really realize like how it comes off. And then also I think like just anybody who's paying attention to the media, you know, in particular, I mean, this is not like Yellowface, like the publishing world as much. I'm not really as familiar with that, but just like in the media, I feel like we've been having these conversations and particularly like, especially when there's someone who takes advantage of this stuff, like, you know, Rachel Dolezal or like Jussie Smollett or like
Chessy icon, Rachel Mary Chessy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Hasan Minhaj, that was like another thing that came up. So these things were like in the ether. And so I don't know, like, I just felt like it was like a topic that people were thinking about and talking about on both sides of the aisle. And it's like, I wanted to write something that was like getting get at all that in a way, but not necessarily come down with like a position or like make it like a speech or like an argument necessarily. You know what I mean?
Right. Do you feel like those people are the people who you've heard from so far who've read the book?
You know, it's been interesting. I heard from a lot of different people. Like I heard from people who are just like, this is a Bronx book. It's set in the Bronx. Sure. So they're just like, this is like a Bronx book. And they're not even really engaging necessarily with the larger themes. They're just like happy that it's like a Bronx book. I've heard with like people of color who are like, finally someone's writing about this. I've heard from like white folks too, who are interested in it or like not necessarily maybe like opening their eyes to some of it or maybe uncomfortable.
Sure.
You know, like it's been an interesting response. Like I feel like there's like, yes, finally this is, I totally get this. Or it's like, this made me uncomfortable, but like, I kind of liked it, or I don't know what I'm supposed to think about it. And I take all of it, honestly, because I was, you know, like I said, I wasn't necessarily setting out to like make an argument, you know? And
right.
So, and I personally like fiction that makes you a little bit uncomfortable. So like when I hear that, I'm like, all right, that's
that
great.
Works for me.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I'll take it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
So one of the questions that came to me like in reading the book was like this idea about privilege, right?
Yeah.
Because Javi sort of, you know, talks about like how he gets like privilege from writing these stories. But do you think that there's a difference between privilege and attention?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think with Javi, he's very mistaken about like what attention, like the significance of it, you know? And that's something
because
I'm
he's obsessed for people. Sorry, if you haven't read the book, he gets obsessed with like the attention and like the clicks and the response on social media and the follow. So he becomes like really like Pavlov's dog around when he publishes and then like the response from the internet.
Yeah. And that's something like I felt was really important to tease out, you know, because I think we're in this world where, you know, we're all kind of like brands at this point. Yeah. Everyone has like a page, you know, and everyone's like posting and like you can get all your data. Whatever, you know, you can see it happening in real time. And I was trying to talk about how, or like get at, you can sometimes mistake these clicks or follows or likes or whatever for like something real and tangible, you know, when it's often a very passive thing that's happening, you know, like you, the receiver of it, it's like, oh my God, I'm getting all this love. But on the other side, it's just like somebody like, you know, clicking or whatever. Like maybe they didn't even read what you wrote. I mean,
yeah,
I used to post.
I've done that.
Yeah, no. So people, I know people do it. Like I was a journalist. I would post this long, like investigative piece. And then people would be like, oh my God, this is terrible. Whatever. I can't believe this. And then I'd look at the stats and it's like four people clicked it, you know, but like a lot of people. So I'm like, you didn't even read it.
The
headline
sounds good.
Yeah.
I'm like, let me support this person. Yeah. I'm not going to read it, but let me just click the heart.
Yeah. Which is cool. But it's like, if you get drunk off of that, it can lead you to some pretty bad places.
Yeah. I mean, this is a tricky question because I can't figure out the exact word. So forgive me if it's a little indelicate,
it's okay.
But I want to know what you were working on with Javi's voice mm-hmm. as our narrator? Because the book is written in the style of a memoir.
Yeah.
So how were you, I guess, thinking about his writing as different from like your own writing? Because like mm-hmm. you, when you are the author and you write as someone else, you are taking on mm-hmm. the role of being that person
while
you're creating the work. But like Javi is clearly different from you. So how were you taking that on? Like, how were you thinking about what he... his opinion versus your opinion?
Yeah. So I wrote it in this like fake memoir style. And that was something I landed on sort of later on in the process. And I, that was great because it allowed me to like, to get into his mind and almost write from like this defensive standpoint, like basically get into his mind where he's like anticipating some of the critiques he's going to get, or like the way people are going to approach the novel or, you know, the memoir, so to speak. Right. Which was cool because it allowed me to like, get deeper into his voice, into his psyche. And that's something else I'm like teasing out here. It's like, it's really like a character study of this guy. And it's like, he's trying to explain to you how I got to where I got to, which is like this messy place at the end. And so it's up to you to like, believe him or like, are you gonna, you know, like you have to sort out the reader. Like, do I believe this guy? Is he just like trying to get over me on me again? Like, what's happening here? And it's like, it creates this like other layer of ambiguity, which I personally like to have. And which, you know, again, when I hear from readers who are like, this challenge me, or this, like, I almost wanted to put it down at some points, but then I kept going and and I was glad I did. Like, I love to hear that. Cause I'm like, I got you like right there. And then you kept going and it's like, it was worthwhile for you to do that. And I don't know, to me, I feel like that's the kind of read that people will think about when they finish, instead of something where it's like it zips through and it's like, that was great. And you just kind of move on, you know?
It's interesting because I feel like one of the things we know about Javi, that he's, at least what he's told us, is that he's maybe not a good writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so I was thinking a lot about that as I'm reading it. I'm like, are we getting, like, is this memoir him, is he improved?
Yeah.
Or is this like, I don't know. It's just really interesting. That's sort of what I was like kind of getting at with that question is like, because the whole book, everyone's like, go deeper, like try harder.
Your writing's
like,
not
I
that
don't
great.
Want to.
Yeah. No, he's kind of lazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. How were you thinking about the memoir in relationship to that sort of stuff?
So it's kind of at the end, kind of try to get it a little bit, but he's, you know, early on, he wants all these writing opportunities or the success. He doesn't even want the opportunities, so to speak. I think he just wants like a blue check mark and like a lot of followers and to be seen as a successful person.
Well, what's funny is in the beginning, he wants to be an author because he wants to be rich. And I was like, this idiot. Already, Javi's a moron.
Right. And it's like, you know, so there's a lot at stake there. But, you know, he comes from this like, you know, background where there's not a lot of writers around him. He has, his dad's a drug dealer. He's grown up with like cash lying around. So he understands, he hears like, oh, you can get $100,000 advance. And in his mind, it's like, I'm going to get like stacks of cash in a bag or something.
Right.
But anyway, he, you know, I think as he's getting these opportunities, he actually really starts to get a little frustrated, I think. And then he kind of wants to write this like quote unquote real thing or something more authentic to him, but he's both afraid of doing that and also afraid that it won't be as well received as like the nicely packaged, you know, adversity stories that he's selling. So I think in a sense too, the memoir is like, I'm going to try to write this real thing, you know, I'm going to try to like tell the story how I've always wanted to tell it and not try to cut the corners and, you know, like this is his like complex, trying hardest work. Whereas like the stuff he's writing for the magazines, he's just like riffing off and lying, getting high and just like, you know, writing it off.
What's funny is like, there's a few times in the book where the real thing is way more interesting than the thing that Javi writes. And I was getting so annoyed because I was like, write about that. I won't say what they are, but, okay, this is a moral question for you because this is something that the book brought up for me and I really haven't decided. So I'm hoping you're going to sway me.
Okay.
Do you think, because what Javi does is he writes about things that are like close to his experience, but he embellishes. And he does that from the start of his college essays all the way through his career. And I'm wondering, do you think if he truly experienced the things that he wrote, mm-hmm. then it would be bad for him to write about them. Like, if those things that he lied about were actually true to his story, do you feel like the lying is the problem or the capitalizing on the oppression is the problem?
It's a great question. I think the capitalizing is sometimes, like, for me, it's a hard question. It's a fine line, right? And again, I don't necessarily have like the clean answers, because it's like in the one sense, it's important to write about your personal experience, especially if they are going to resonate with people who have gone through similar experiences, right?
Right.
And if they're about like groups of people who are marginalized and who don't get the same shine as others, right? So that's important. But it's like, I guess to me, it's like if you're doing it, it's like intention. Right. Mm-hmm. If the intention is like, I'm really trying to explain something in a way that's not going to be explained if someone else writes this story, and then as a result, I'm going to go into my personal background mm-hmm. and history to do that because that's important. And me personally, like, again, this is me speaking personally. I think everyone who wants to do it can do it their own way. But to me, that's how I look at it. Like, I'm going to do that when it feels like necessary and useful. But if I'm doing it like self-servingly, and it's like mm-hmm. I just know that whatever magazine is going to take the story because it's like they're going to love this type of thing,
right?
Especially if it's something that's like really personal, like I'm going to air out family business and stuff like that. And it's like, why do I really need to do that? Like, what is this serving, you know? And it's so it's like a really fine line, and I think a lot of writers find themselves in that position. And it's something like, especially writers of color, that I feel like, yeah, I have this like tragic thing in my family line or like my parents or whatever. Do I just write about it to write about it because I know it's going to become like a front page story in this magazine I want to get into? Or do I like save it, which is like a weird thing to say, right? For something else. Like, it's like, and it's just weird. And I think it speaks to the bigger issues of like a lot of these publications and the way this like writing system is set up. It's like, if you're a person of color, you kind of have to like trade on these stories in a way that like a white writer or like someone else maybe doesn't have to, you know, or like think about these things, you know what I mean? I don't know if it's a clear answer, to be honest.
No, I don't think there is a clear answer.
Yeah.
Where my head's at is like, I sort of feel like the lying is less bad to me. Like, I sort of don't think lying is like the worst thing in the world. I do think like if you're a journalist and you're reporting a story, need to report the truth. But I think if you're writing like an opinion piece, I don't know. I don't want you to lie, but like, to me, lying is not the greatest sin. Like, I think sometimes people act like lying is the worst thing you could possibly do. And I just don't feel that way. Like, sometimes I think you have to lie. Like, sometimes I just think it hurts people's feelings less. It's not worth it. Sometimes I lie just so that I look like more of the bad guy to like protect other people. Like, I think there's reasons and times to lie.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm not so like, I wasn't so like morally opposed to what Javi does, like these stretchings of the truth. To me, I think the even being asked to write these things is like the most offensive thing in the world, right? Mm-hmm, like this idea that like this, like the editor, but even like, because the thing that's, I mean, of course, so interesting is like, yes, you take the end takes us to like the media landscape. But before, we're talking about high school and like getting into programs and getting into college and just like being in a classroom and like lying to feel comfortable in a classroom, or like lying to feel comfortable in like a, you know, like it's like the Latino group that he's a part of. But it could be the Black Student Union. It could be, you know, it could be any organization within a campus, but like lying or like punching up your story to feel like you fit in. And I think all of that, like capitalizing on the oppression, to me is a lot like yuckier because it's like continuing to to like feed these narratives and like continuing to make it so that an editor can say like, you should write about this, because that's like where we quote unquote people of color think that our value is, you know? I guess, and to that point, I want to talk about the intra-community sort of language performance, progressive liberalism stuff that you're getting at. Because you are sort of skewering progressives in a lot of ways, I would say. I guess, or do you feel that way, that you are doing that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I was trying to just skewer a lot of things. Like, you know what I mean? Just like bring up a lot of stuff and it's like, what's really happening here, you know? So like, I didn't... I wouldn't say I was like necessarily only going at them, but
no, not only, but they take a brunt.
Take a brunt because, like, you know, I think it's the most frustrating part, like, as moving through this world as a writer of color. Like, I just feel like there is, like, yeah, we want your voice, and I'm like, dope, cool, but then it's like, but if you only write about these types of things, and it's like,
right,
and that just sucks, you know, to hear that over and over. And I don't think that people sometimes understand what that does to you as well, or like what it conveys to you, the writer. It's like, you're only valuable if you write about these types of things, you know?
Right. But what about like the, like within like the Latino student group?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a lot of performance going on in there.
Yeah.
And I felt like, I mean, I felt like I read that you were sort of, you had opinions about that too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
like,
I mean,
Anaïs, the girlfriend.
Yeah, I think the performance, you know, that happens, especially the kind of place on a college campus, right, where you get all these students who, you know, like, let's say Latino students, for example, they come from all types of backgrounds, right? Like, there's Javi, who's like kind of a poor kid from the Bronx. There's Anaïs, who's like from the suburbs in Albany. There's like kids who, you know, come from all types of backgrounds. And when you get on a college campus, especially like a primarily white institution where you're just lumped together as POC or the Latino students, there's sort of like this jockeying that starts to occur for like position and status, because you're sort of like jockeying for that position to be noticed in a lot of ways amongst the greater student population, right? It's something that I saw that happen a lot at Cornell. Where I went for undergrad, it's like
shots fired, Cornell.
I mean, you know, it's another, but it's something that I hear from a lot of people who go to schools like that and who come from backgrounds like mine, you know, where it's like you're thrust into this campus. There's only a few of you. And then I don't know, like if you want certain positions or you want to be get into some secret societies or whatever, like there's all these weird shit that goes on, like people want on campus. And it's like, you kind of have to make yourself stand out in some ways. And so I was trying to get at that and how, like, I don't know, when you get to college, it's this like new performance space in a lot of ways where you're like trying out different identities that you didn't really have a chance to like try out when you were in high school, when you were back home, where everybody knows you. And it's like, like you're not really like that, because like nobody's around you that really knows you. You can kind of make up whoever you want to be. So,
And I also feel like sort of on the flip side is like, you also don't even know that these are options for you sometimes.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Like
not even
because like Javi comes from the Bronx, but just like when you get to college, you meet all sorts of people and you're like, whoa, like I can talk like this. Or like, I can dress like that.
Yeah.
Or like,
yeah.
I didn't know people like this kind of food. Like there's just so much that, you know, can change for you when you are in a new space, which I think like Javi really plays with, like language and like discovering like like buzzwords and stuff.
Yeah, all these like big academic terms, and it's like, oh, I can, what does this do? Like, you know, I'm gonna try these on. Yeah,
like, and it shifts the energy in the room, or like it has an impact. Like, but it's so, I guess let's take a break.
Okay,
and I'll ask this on the other side. Okay, y'all, this past week, I threw a party in LA to celebrate the LA Times Book Festival and just generally bookish people all around. And it was the best time. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on Instagram, but I have to say a huge thank you to Lit Cocktails for helping make this party a total blast. Lit Cocktails is a mobile bartending company that provides a fun, personable, unique, yet professional experience for clients who want more than your average boring black tie bartenders. They're here for weddings, birthday parties, corporate events, or any other reason you might need to celebrate with a cocktail. Lit Cocktails is owned and operated by Diamond Davis, a Black LGBTQ woman who started the company after losing her job as a restaurant manager during the 2020 pandemic. Diamond has created more than just a service. It is truly an experience, and it celebrates diversity, love, and community. I could feel that from the bar the entire evening. Diamond was a joy to have. She made the best drinks, always had a smile on her face, and honestly became one of my new favorite people. Lit cocktail packages include ice, garnishes, cups, napkins, straws, a customized menu, two specialty cocktails, non-alcoholic beverages and mixers, one free hour of setup and breakdown, and an alcohol shopping list. Literally, you don't need to do anything but hire Diamond. She takes care of the rest. They also offer tastings for an additional fee where they customize 8 to 10 drinks based on your flavor profile, and they'll even bring them to your home for you to sample. Go book a free consultation today by visiting www.litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. Again, that's litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stax tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stax merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestax, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestax now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/thestax.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. This is, I think, my big question for you, because this is something that I've seen on the internet from people who've read the book.
Okay.
Is there's this sort of like conversation about the straw man argument of this book, right? Like, if this book falls into the wrong hands, it gives the wrong kind of person the ability to be like, see, affirmative action is stupid and there's no such thing as racism and all these people are just making it up. It's a performance. They're just fucking with white people. Like, they don't really feel bad. Like, this poor kid from the Bronx doesn't even see racism. He's just using this word. So, like, how do you grapple with that argument? Which I think personally is like pretty bad faith, but I do understand where it comes from. And I am curious, like, if you've seen it, if you've heard it, what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it maybe in a couple like Goodreads reviews and stuff like that,
you know,
which I do read them. People tell me not to, but I
don't
read them.
Don't do that. Don't read them.
Just because I don't know. I honestly appreciate anybody who reads the book and who takes the time to write about it. But I don't know. Maybe I should.
I know people who have friends who read them for them.
Yeah.
And then if people say like really nice things, they might send it to the author.
Okay.
Don't be over there. You don't need it.
Yeah. No, I hear that. So, I mean, no, I think it's a really important question, and it's something that, like, I know, me personally, I know that that's not what I was trying to get at with this.
Sure.
Book, right? You know what I mean? So it's like, and I know what I stand for. And so it's the type of thing that like I kind of can't control it. You know what right. I mean? Like it's once it's out in the world, if people want to run with it, that's their prerogative. I think that if you read the book closely enough and like generously enough, you will see that that's not really what
right.
trying to be said. But it's like I could totally see somebody doing that and feeling like yeah. they think that they're right, you know, or whatever. But like me as the author at that point, it's like kind of out of my hands, you know, like right. I spent my time on it. I know that I was trying to get at some bigger questions, and the idea that like none of that stuff exists isn't necessarily one of them. But, you know, if that's what people take away from it, I don't know. Like I can't go out and like necessarily stop them, or maybe if they at me or something and I'd be like, well, I don't know if you got it right. You know,
don't respond. But they do. If they at you, do not respond. Back away slowly. Let me just tell you, don't, as a debut author, let me give you some advice.
Right.
If they at you, pretend like you didn't see it. You've never been on the internet. What is Instagram? Never heard of it.
I'm still learning. I still got a lot of bronze.
Do not engage. Oh my gosh. Do not engage. I just think, I mean, it's an interesting question because I think
it is.
The thing about satire is that it requires like irony and mm-hmm. You know, it requires that the author has a wink and a nod to the mm-hmm. audience. Yeah. So if you're not in that in group, you don't necessarily get the joke. And I understand how some people can read the book and be like, oh, this is advocating for XYZ. Obviously, that's not your intention. But I'm just curious, like, as a person who's written it, and it sounds like you sort of were like, well, that's your problem, not mine. But it is something that I think about. Because like, I remember when I read The Sellout by Paul Beatty. Like,
I was just going to bring him up.
That's one of the first satire books I really like tried to read for real mm-hmm. that was about people of color. And I really struggled. I actually want to go back and revisit it because now I feel like I'm sort of into satire now, specifically by people of color.
Yeah.
So now I'm like, I want to go back because the first half I really liked and I felt like I really got it. And then the second half I was like, what is happening here? And I read it before I ever started this podcast, like before I really started like thinking and talking a lot about books. So I understand how when you read satire, if it doesn't click for you or if like you're not part of the audience, that you could feel like you were reading something that's maybe not there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And I think me as a writer as well, like Paul Beatty's somebody that I admire tremendously and I love his work. And I think he's as important as he is because he's like he's kind of fearless. I mean, the premise of that novel was wild, right? Like,
yeah.
So, and like, even to like say that, like, it's just a crazy, you know, like reinstating, this guy wants to reinstate slavery, like black guy. Like, it's like a crazy thing to say out loud. But then when you read it, you know, it's a phenomenal book. And I think as the writer, like for so many years, I try to limit myself to make sure like, okay, only the right people are going to get what I'm saying here. Like mm-hmm. anything that like I'm going to pull things away because I'm, you know, and I think the work suffered because I was too concerned with that, you know, and I had to make a choice where I was like, you know, I really want to write about this stuff. I have a way that I really think should be written about. And that I think would, you know, sort of like advance the conversation a little bit more, but it's a little risky. And like, again, I had to fall back on like, I know what my intentions are here. Hopefully I succeed for the most part. And the outliers, that's going to happen, you know, and that's just, it is what it is. But, you know, I feel like proud of the book. And I think it's because I know like I didn't pull back, you know, or like try to make sure carefully curate that like only the right people got it and the wrong people did not get it, you know. And I think you lose something when you do that, you know, when you try to play that game. Yeah,
I agree. I mean, I think it's pretty crucial to satire to like be specific and like that not everybody's on the inside of the joke.
Right.
Some people are on the outside. Since you read your Goodreads reviews now, I'm really curious. Is there any criticism of the book that you've heard that you've agreed with? Or you've been like, yeah, I could have done that better.
There was a few people who were like, you know, he didn't deal like the father. It's really early on, but it's like the first chapter, so I don't think it's a spoiler. Yeah. But the father is killed early on, right? And he's, you know, grows up fatherless. And there was a few people who were like, "Oh, I wish you would have explored that more," you know. Mm-hmm. And that's something where I was like, I thought about that, and I'm trying to like with this next book to do that, but it was also I was trying to do so many things that I was like, I can't, like, I have a little bit of that in there, but I guess I could see where I could have maybe done more of that, but I think it would have been kind of a different novel. And also when I was writing this, I was processing my own fatherlessness and so becoming a dad. And like, so this is all stuff I'm like thinking more and more about now that I hopefully will translate to the next book. But I've seen people say that. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, I just, I didn't think I had the ability to do that.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And like everything doesn't go in every book. I'm just so curious because most authors do not read. So I never get to ask them about criticism, but I'm obsessed with criticism.
I know my editor last week for the book tour, she was like, don't read, you know, my agent and my editor were like, don't read the book reviews. But, well, I don't know. Like I was a journalist for so long and I would get these wild ass emails like from people all day who just didn't read the story and were just like, just looked at my name and didn't like me or my picture or whatever. And so it kind of like desensitized me because I saw a lot of them were like not even, it was clear to see like, to like which ones were like actually trying to give a pointed critique and which ones were just like, I don't like you, you know, and I'm going to spew my hatred on this site or whatever, this email platform. And so,
Yeah, no, I get it. I like criticism. I'm obviously so interested in it, but I also, I come from a theater background. And so we do a lot of constructive criticism. In the
It's
so collaborative. So I really like criticism. I like when people, I mean, when people tell me I talk with vocal fry or whatever, I'm like, oh, you can fucking die. But if they say something actually critical about the show or like something that I've done, I really like it. It's the hard part about a place like Goodreads is you can't sift that for yourself. Like you can't sift good, interesting critique from Andrew's an idiot. You know, like it's like, okay, not helpful. I might be an idiot, but could you explain why?
But if I see that, like if I see it, me personally, if I see that, I'm like, all right, whatever. I'm gonna scroll back. Cause like, I don't, you're not even really engaging. Right. You know what I mean? If you give me a one star, you write this like really immersive, like I'm gonna read it. I might even like it. I'm like, all right. Maybe I don't agree with you, but I appreciate you taking the time to do that. You know?
Yeah, like, no, for sure. For sure. That's a good outlook. Was there ever a different title for the book or was it always Victims?
It had so many titles. It was called Double Dutch at first. Like, which is, because I was like trying to write about this friendship story and like these two friends who grew up in the same neighborhood and take vastly different paths. And then the idea of like bouncing from one sort of like existence identity, growing up in the identity, you know, this like Bronx, like lower class whatever identity, and then being in places like Cornell and these magazines and stuff I was writing for, and like how I always never felt like comfortable because I felt like I was like, I don't know, felt like I was doing this weird dance between these like two spaces. And then it was called The Hype for a while, and that that was like, again, that was like when the social media stuff I was trying to write about and get into all that, and then Victim. I think that was the only three. It might have been another one in between that.
I like it. I like. I feel like because Victims like such a seems like such an obvious title for this book. So I was curious if there was
It was like that came way later.
And what about the cover? Were you involved at all at that process?
You know what? Like, I wish I could say that I was like, yeah, put dominoes with it. That was totally the cover artist and the designer, and it was beautiful. Like they sent. I've heard horror stories about people's cover process, but they sent that to me and I was like, that's fucking gorgeous.
Was
like,
it the first one?
No, like we changed some color schemes, but the dominoes were there, like, you know, that was there. I had given some input on color schemes and like I wanted it to look like a bodega awning. Okay. Like, you know, and like or like the color palette of that or whatever.
Yeah.
So I had some input like that, but the dominoes was, that was beautiful. Cause that's cool. I'm Puerto Rican and like we like so it hits on like multiple levels. It's like not only the story, but the playing dominoes, culture. So yeah, I love it. I love the cover so much.
Do Puerto Rican people play a lot of dominoes?
Hell yeah.
I think of that as being such a Black thing.
No, we play, we play tons of dominoes,
I love this for
us. That's huge.
Let's play dominoes.
I'm down.
I'm so bad, because I'm so bad at math. I'm so slow. I'm like,
I'm a super like passive, like there's people in my family who do the calculate. They're like the freaking, that meme with all the math in the air. Like, I can't do all that. I'm just like, that's a six. Okay, I got two. Maybe I should do this one. You know,
no, I can't think fast enough. I can't think fast enough for my little like dominoes. I'm like, what do I have here? So my brother will help me.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes. But then if I do too good, then he stops helping.
And I'm like, it's 10. He's like, it's 8, you idiot. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, it's 8. I also hate Scrabble. Scrabble.
I'm so bad at Scrabble.
Scrabble is my personal nemesis.
Oh my God.
People bring it out, I leave the room. I'm like, no.
It's the worst because everyone assumes I'm going to be good at it. I'm like, I'm so bad.
I'm a notorious, terrible speller. Are you a good speller?
No.
What's a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh man. You know, lately I've had to write out excerpt a lot. Like people are asking for excerpts or I'm like looking for excerpts. I'm typing it in emails and it's super hard. I always spell it wrong.
Excerpt?
Yeah, I think.
Hey, I've never spelled a word right on this there show before. It's so funny because some words you can just spell and some words you just can't.
Or cue, like the formal lineup cue.
There's multiple E's. That's a word that it's not a word that is used in California. You idiots in New York are like, I'm in the queue.
I'm in the queue or whatever. I'm online.
Like it's in line. You only need one version. You don't need online or queue or whatever. Yeah. In line. A thing I hated about New York was that those two phrases.
Oh, really?
Queue and online. Online? You're not on a line.
I'm standing on line. Yeah.
But is there a line you're physically standing on? No, you're in a line of other humans. See, this is why we butt heads, because you don't believe my words are better than your words, and they are.
I never not believed in Chesty. I was just like, I never heard that before. That's all.
You were doubting a little bit. You were doubting. And the other, I can't remember who it was we were with, Arvin maybe, and he was also
Irving,
doubting.
You two were
doubting me together, and that was part of the problem, is that you two were ganging up and both being like, I've never heard that before. And then I was like looking for a lifeline, and I got it from Instagram.
Not my recollection. I don't know.
Okay, tell me about how you wrote the book. Where were you? How often do you write? How many hours a day? Yeah. Music or no? Do you have TV on in the background? Snacks or beverages? Set the scene.
Okay. So I write from 5 to 7 a.m. every day. Well, Monday through Friday.
What time do you wake up to start writing at 5?
Like 5. I get up at 5. I used to make coffee and do all this stuff. That was like before I had my kids and I had like my own little like writing room. Right. That writing room became my son's room and then it became my son and daughter's room. So now I write at the dining table outside of my bedroom. And I don't make coffee because it makes too much noise and I don't want to wake them up. For a while, like when I was really sleepy, I would make like pre-workout. You know,
like the caffeine, like
I put it in some like seltzer, like and make a little fake cocktail and just like have some of that. And then I was like, that's probably not good to have that much caffeine in your body, like right away. So I stopped doing that. But yeah, it's not glamorous at all. It's like me in the dark, like with minimal light now, like not trying to wake people up on my dining table.
So no music either then, I guess.
No, I don't really do music. Honestly, I just like writing that early in the morning because there's no distractions. There's nothing going on. I'm somebody who can be easily, like if I see an email or something or a notification, I'll go off and start scrolling and I'd lose like half an hour, 45 minutes. Same. And it's like, now that I have kids, it's like, I really can't. Like if that time is gone, it's gone. It's never coming back for the rest of the day. So I really try to just like focus on those 2 hours. Snacks wise, I'm not a big snacker either. I know. I feel like I'm like, it's like
really letting me down here.
I like reward myself afterwards sometimes.
With?
You know, I really like yogurt, granola. Like I know.
Whoa. I like yogurt. No, the biggest disappointment of my life, I talk about this all the time, is when Clint Smith told me that he eats clementines because clementines are like candy. And I was like, no, they're like oranges. Candy is candy. Clementines are oranges. Like, let's be real.
That's a cool mental trick, though, you know, if you want to shoot yourself that way.
I love yogurt, so I can actually Greek the Faye brand.
Nah, I get the, like, the what's Chobani or, like, Winn-Dixie brand. Yeah,
And then do you put fruit, honey, granola?
When I'm like trying to be fancy, I put some fruit with my kids, you know.
Okay.
But if it's me feverishly eating, I'll just
put straight up granola. Plain?
No, I'm not a savage. I put granola.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But like the flavor is plain.
Oh, yeah, plain.
Okay. I go with a plain Faye, the one F-A-G-E, you know, 2%.
I need to see that one.
You'll recognize it. It's very common. It's like the other one besides Chobani. Okay. And I do a Kind granola, the like oats and coconut. And then I like the jumbo blueberries and honey. That's really my vibe. Or if blackberries are in season, I go with that too. Okay. I do not like a strawberry. I think strawberry is a bullshit fruit.
What?
Yeah. Strawberry is a fake good fruit. Great strawberries are great, but a regular strawberry is not a good fruit.
How could you say a strawberry is not a real fruit?
It is a real fruit. It's just bullshit. It's just like people talk about strawberries like, oh my God, strawberries.
It's and I'm delicious. Like, no. It's delicious. When they're like
a regular strawberry, just a standard, not like a exceptional farmer's market, perfect strawberry in the middle of July, but just like if you were to go get strawberries today.
Yeah.
Bullshit. That is an unserious fruit, okay? Strawberries need to get it together. This is such a hot take. I feel like people are going to be upset about this, but it's true for me. Okay, what about, when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I knew when I was 16, I decided that I wanted to.
Because you thought you were going to get $100,000?
No.
Like actually, hobby?
No, actually the opposite. I had always liked writing, always liked reading. Uh-huh. But I was actually, you know, most of my friends growing up, we didn't have houses. We all lived in apartments. And I had one friend whose dad was an engineer in the Bronx. And they had a house. And I was like, damn, you got a house? I want a house. So in my mind, I was like, I'm going to be an engineer. And then I realized what you have to do to become an engineer. Take science, all these classes. Right. Like, I
have to be good at dominoes.
Yeah, exactly. I had no conception of any of that. And so when I figured that out, I was like, you know what? Maybe I'm not going to care as much about making money. I'm just going to try to find something that I actually enjoy doing. Like, what do I enjoy doing? What am I good at that I enjoy? And I was like, writing. And so I decided at that point, and I really haven't looked back. Like, I started writing for local newspapers, did journalism for like 10 years. And it's, you know, it's basically been the thing I've done. I haven't really done anything else.
Wow. And you taught?
Yeah, I taught writing at University of Miami. I taught it in prison for a couple years as well. And I did a couple summer programs here in Miami in Opa-locka.
Do you have another job now or are you strictly a writer?
No. I have a day job now. I work for Edutopia, which is an education company. We write and edit articles for teachers. It's like about research, innovative practices. So I've always been involved.
What's that like in Florida right now?
Well, I love working for them because they're focused on solutions, right? So we don't really write about the crazy political nonsense going on. And there's a lot of it, sadly, but we just focus on like, hey, this research, you know, these practices, according to research, are something you might want to try in your classroom, right? And highlight it and break it down for teachers. So it's kind of like in the weeds a little bit, but I enjoy it because I hear from teachers all the time about how much of an impact it makes and how because we're not focusing on like the crazy political nonsense, like it's cutting above the noise. And it's like, I could actually use this in my classroom. And like, so education is something that's like hugely important to me. I went to public schools mostly and then got a scholarship to go to a Catholic school for high school. And that was like, I've just seen like so many facets of the system that like, I'm very invested in trying to like improve it and whatever.
And then you went to a fancy Ivy League.
Then I went to a fancy Ivy League school.
Very fancy. Cornell.
Very fancy. Yes.
The second best school in New York State behind NYU, my alma mater. Okay. We have a little time so we can talk about baseball because you're a baseball fan.
Yeah, let's do it.
First of all, you need to tell the people what the hell is wrong with you. You're from the Bronx, but you're a Mets fan. It's insane. I've never heard of this before. And I lived in New York for 8 years. I've never met a person from the Bronx. I even lived in the Bronx and I've never met someone from the Bronx roots for the Mets. It's crazy.
I know a few.
Okay, well, you probably know more people. Yeah. I lived there for like 6 months, but still, like, it's a crazy, it's not normal. Okay.
I'll grant you that. Yeah. So basically what happened is my stepdad, who, you know, he was with my mom for a while. He was in my life and he's still in my life, but living with me and stuff. When I was like 10 or 11, he got into me young. He's a huge Mets fan from the Bronx, grew up in the projects. For whatever reason, he's a Mets fan. His dad's a Mets fan. And so he got into me young. And yeah, like that was the first team I ever really started to watch. And I fell in love with them. Yankee fans are so annoying. I mean, you lived in New York.
Yankee fans are awful.
They're mad annoying, you know? And it's like, and especially in the Bronx, they just talk about how many championships they won. And like, this is when they had, like, I was growing up, they had Jeter and like Andy Pettit. A-Rod too, you know, A-Rod too, I was already almost
Giambi?
They had Giambi, Bernie Williams, you know, this was like 90s, early 2000s. Okay, okay. And they were like a dynasty. They were just winning every year.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think part of me also, like, I've always rooted for underdogs, you know, sure. And like, I identify more with the Mets. I feel more like an underdog. So sure. for whatever reason, they've always been my team. There's been a lot of misery. We've never won a championship in my lifetime.
When were you born? Because they won in 86, right?
I was 91. So.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah.
They won the year I was born. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Been born when I was born, then you could have had it.
I'm hopeful that I will see it one day.
Are they going to be any good this year?
No. Probably not. I mean, no. I can't even lie to you. I'd be like, yeah, we're going to be great. If we go like 500, I will be happy, to be honest. We win 84 games, I'll be a happy person. Yeah.
Can I sell you on a book right now?
Please.
It came out today when we're recording. It's called Charlie Hustle.
Yes.
It's the new book about Pete Rose. Are you interested in that at all?
I am interested in that
book.
It's
fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm so, like, legitimately, every time I have a free moment, I'm listening to audio and I'm putting it on. And I just got to The Investigator. I'm so excited because, I mean, you and I are both too young to actually, I mean, that it happened when I was like two, I guess.
Yeah.
And I knew sort of the idea of Pete Rose. I knew he was a cheater. I knew he gambled on baseball. I didn't understand the magnitude of who he was, how long he was a player manager. He'd been in the league since like the 60s. He's like, he was a real fucking asshole. The chestiest. He's the king of the chesties. Like, truly, this book, I'm so into it, but it's a hard sell because a lot of people don't care about baseball. And I get that, but I care about baseball and I love baseball history. And so for me, I'm like, who can I push this book
on? I would totally read that book. That night I met you, Lisa.
Oh, yeah.
Lucas was there.
I think that's
her. Yeah. So I've seen her post about it and I'm like, okay. Yeah,
it's really good. And I was like, do I care about Pete Rose? And the audiobook's almost 15 hours. And I was like, do I care about Pete Rose for 15 hours? And you know what? I have 2 hours left and I fucking do. I care about him so much for two more hours. Yeah. Well, the only thing I care about this year in baseball is that the Dodgers don't win. Because I'm a Giants fan and I fucking hate the Dodgers. And all of my predictions are I'm taking the field against the Dodgers. And
you guys,
thanks to Shohei Ohtani, I might actually win my bet.
I think the Dodgers are not going to be as good as people think they are.
I hope not.
Yeah. And the Giants, I'm not sure. But you guys got Blake Snell, right?
I don't know.
You got to pitch Blake Snell. He's good. So
I don't know. I've stopped being a Giants fan and I've started just becoming a Dodger hater. Like I feel like I know more about the Dodgers than I do the Giants.
You can hate on them. Yeah.
Yes. Cause I live here. Ugh. Like, I'm like, please pitch Clayton Kershaw in the postseason.
That is how I felt living in New York.
Yes,
right.
And I get it.
And being around Yankee fans. Cause they were like that. Yeah.
I get it. Well, I understand why people from other boroughs in New York are not Yankee fans, but Bronx people, it's just so, like, I feel like everyone from the Bronx, our whole personality is like, Yankees.
When you're born in the hospital, they give you a Yankees fitted. They just like,
instead of like the stupid bow, they just put a
Yankees fitted on you in the Bronx.
Yeah. Take this Yankees hat. That's my Bronx accent. Thank you. Okay. We got to get out of here soon. Let me ask you this. Do you know what comes next for you?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of mentioned, like, I'm trying to, like, this whole, all the issues that are covered in Victim were things that were like, I was obsessing about for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. That's why I wrote about it. And I feel like I got out of my system. And so, like, now what I'm most obsessing over is like parenthood, fatherhood. Like, what does it mean to be a good modern dad? Or what does that even look like? Or like a man, like, it's just like a weird space and time we're in. And so I don't know exactly what it'll be. But it'll probably be some fictional story around that. And
who's the coolest person who's expressed interest or excitement about Victim?
Fab Five Freddy.
Oh,
yeah.
Holy shit. That's very cool. He read it?
I sent it to him. I met him way back when I did a story about Jean-Michel Basquiat, like in 2009 or something. Okay. And we hung out a little bit and like, I was like, oh, you're so fucking cool. And I was like 20 years old. I was like, it's Fat Five Freddy. Anyway, so I sent him the book and he like shared it on Facebook the other day. He's like, I can't wait to read this. I'm like, oh, shit.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah.
For people who love Victim, what are some other things you might recommend that are in conversation?
Paul Betty, the sellout for sure. Matt Johnson's work. He's another writer I'm a huge fan of. Loving Day. It's an excellent book. Danzy Senna.
Queen.
Yeah, I can't wait to read her new novel. But
it's so fucking good.
New People was great.
Oh, the new one's even better.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It looks amazing. And Yellowface too. Yellowface was last year. You know, publishing industry sort of centered, but definitely in conversation.
I think Erasure too, right?
First of all. Erasure as well. I'm ashamed to admit I have not read Erasure. I had it on my shelf for like a long time. And then...
Did you see the movie, American Fiction?
I did. And I did see the movie and now I'm like,
the book's way better.
I know. So now I got to read the book. But I've been meaning to read it for a long time.
I mean, it's definitely like in conversation for sure. I think even more so than Yellowface.
Yeah, it's a book that I always heard about and like I bought it and I don't know, I feel like in like 2014, 2015 or something, I like tried to read it and for whatever reason, I couldn't do it at that time yet. Yeah. Maybe I wasn't ready yet, but now I'm definitely.
Now you're ready. Yeah, you're ready. It's your time. Last question. If you could have one person dead or alive read this book, who would you want it to be?
Oh, man. I would say he's alive, but mostly because his last album, I feel like, dealt with a lot of this. Kendrick Lamar. I feel like he would like it.
Did you like the newest album of his?
I love all his
stuff. Is that the one where he talks about like his aunt?
Yes. I love all his stuff. And it's probably like not something I would revisit as often as maybe like his first album necessarily. But I think he was exploring a lot of interesting topics and growth and like development for himself. And I don't know, I listened to it again recently and I was like, I feel like you would like the book, but I have no way of reaching him. So maybe.
Oh, interesting. All right, everybody. You've been listening to a conversation with me and Andrew Barriga, and he's the author of Victim, and the book is out in the world and you can get it wherever you get your book. Have you listened to the audiobook?
Yes, it's excellent.
Is it? My friend said it was good. I didn't listen. I just read it off the page. Okay. The audiobook's good too. Trust Andrew and trust Sarah. Fiction Matters Sarah. She says it's good on audio. Anyways, get the book wherever you guys get your books. It's out now in the world. Andrew, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Yay. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Andrew Barriga for joining the show. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for April is The January Children by Safia El-Hilo, which we will discuss on Wednesday, April 24th with our guest, Hala Alyan. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And of course, check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.